Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and assistant professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I am excited to be interviewing Christopher Wood about his book, A History of Art History, which was published by Princeton University Press in September of 2019. Dr. Wood is currently professor of German at New York University. From 1992 until 2014, he taught in the Department of the History of Art at Yale University. He is the author of several important books, including Forgery, Replica, Fiction, Temporalities of German Renaissance Art, and my personal favorite, Anachronic Renaissance, which he co-authored with Alexander Nagel. In 2002, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, as well as a Rome Prize Fellowship to the American Academy in Rome. He is the recipient of several further fellowships and is also currently a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The book we'll be discussing today marks a landmark contribution to the understanding of art history. In it, Dr. Wood tracks the evolution of the historical study of art from the late Middle Ages through to the rise of the modern scholarly discipline of art history, synthesizing and assessing a vast array of writings, episodes, and personalities. This wide-ranging account, the first of its kind in English, explores the development of art historical thinking over more than 1,000 years. I am very happy to get to discuss this book with its author today, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Christopher Wood, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Allison. It's a privilege and an honor to be speaking with you. Thank you very much.
I'm very excited about this episode, this book, you know, lots to talk about today. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, beginning off just by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, where you attended graduate school, any mentors you had along the way, maybe how you first became interested in art history. I always find this a kind of interesting thing to prod at. So just give us some of your background, if you would.
Well, I was born in Boston, and that's the Athens of America, and with excellent museums, the Museum of Fine Arts and the Isabel Stewart Gardner Museum. And I actually grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, but I was frequently in Boston, and I got to know those museums pretty well. But they were for me, you know, just kind of immediate, highly personalized, moving experiences. And I kept it all separate and away from my studies, which were gravitating towards history and literature. And that's what I majored in college at Harvard, European, English, French, and German history and literature. But art history was kind of lurking in the background. I was curious about it. And then after college, I got a fellowship to the University of Munich in Munich, Germany. And this was a big adventure for me. I mean, the idea of going off for a year and studying, and I didn't know what I wanted to study. I just wanted to sample all the classes. It was like starting college over again. And I looked into some philosophy courses, some history courses. But then I poked my head into the auditorium where the art history lectures were being given, and there were 1,000 people in the audience. Yes, and at Harvard, you know, where art history, you know, has a distinguished tradition, there were never more than 20 or 30. I mean, you had survey classes with maybe 100 or 150 students, but most lecture courses, you know, 10, maybe 20. Everything was on a kind of, you know, homemade amateur scale. And so it kind of provincialized Harvard. I suddenly thought, you know, in Germany, in Munich, art history is a major discipline. Clearly, the students take it seriously. The university takes it seriously. I just felt there was this kind of tremendous intellectual investment. So I started learning about the history of the discipline. And I suddenly realized that the discipline is a relatively modern discipline. It had joined the faculties only at the very end of the 19th century in Germany. And I quickly learned, as I was learning German and reading more and more, that that for much of its modern history, in the from the late 18th till well into the 20th century and even into our century, is in some sense fundamentally a German project in a way. And well, anyways, I got all interested in art history as a kind of intellectual project, art history as a dimension, let's say, of modern intellectual history, modern cultural history. It's the interaction between art history as a discipline and modernism in the arts. Because after all, they're contemporaneous. Art history emerged as a serious field of academic study in the late 19th century and flourished in the early 20th century. And you know this better than I, exactly in the generations of what we now call, you know, high modernism. So that's kind of how I sort of academicized it in a way. But then I suddenly realized that, well, art is historical and art is coordinated with history. And I would say, in a way, that's been the main theme of art history. That's why it's called art history. It's the attempt to tell the story of art's evolution, but always coordinated with extra artistic reality. That idea, which we sometimes call the contextual study of art or the social history of art. Many people think it was invented in the 1960s or 70s in Britain and America, but in fact, it goes right back to the beginning of art history. You know this, that in the 19th century, that was the default mode of art history, was to coordinate it with worldviews and mentalities, to think about social structures, to think about the economics of patronage. All of this was what art history had to offer. And I, you know, immersed myself in this and got excited about, for example, Michael Baxendall, which everyone really since the 70s, everyone of my generation, but also younger, still thinks of his books on Renaissance art as somehow exemplary and still kind of guideposts for us in many ways. And in fact, I felt that I was, in a way, recapitulating Baxendall's story, because if you read his memoir, which he published right at the end of his life, he also had a kind of much more sort of naive, bodily, I think his father was an antiques dealer or something. I mean, he had this kind of basic relationship to art that many of us have when we're growing up. I'm sure you did too, just wanting to be in museums, but wanting to own a few precious things. We all had that. But how did Baxendall academicize his intimacy with art? The same way I did. He went to Munich. After college, he went to university, and then he got himself to Munich and studied and listened to lectures in the very same rooms that I did, but a generation earlier. And also in those very halls of the same university, somehow got a sense of the full intellectual possibilities of the discipline. But then, and just to kind of wrap up this kind of arc of the story, is that no sooner had I become a contextualist than I became disillusioned. And I thought that somehow to explain art historically was to betray it, in fact, or even worse, just to miss the point entirely. And I still feel that, Allison, and that's why the point of my book and really my overall point of view and campaign is that I'm protective of art history as a project, okay? But I'm protective of art most of all, and what I want to do is explain and also promote a kind of art history that is highly respectful of art, where art remains somehow mysterious, somehow just beyond the reach of our historical explanations. It sounds like a paradoxical formulation, but I want to say that the strongest historical explanations are the ones that recognize their limits. They're the ones that they know exactly what about art they cannot explain. And that makes for powerful and moving art history, I think. So I tried to write a history of that project.
Yeah. Well, I think you definitely do that. And I'm so glad that you're kind of blending this initial question of how did you come to art history with how you got to writing this book and what this book, what its driving impetus is in many ways. Because I think, you know, maybe those who encounter the book, and it is not a small or insignificant text. I mean, this is a weighty tome, I think, compared to many books that are coming out in art history that really seem to be capped at 100,000 words, you know, aren't often more than 200, 250 pages. This is a packed 400 pages of exactly what you were just describing, really trying to dig at the groundwork of not just what the history of art history is, but why we do, you know, what we do, how different people have done it different ways in different eras. I mean, you come at this problem and real desire that you're describing to honor art and question, have we gotten it right? Who got it better? You know, like that comes across very strongly in the book. So maybe as a follow-up question, I was going to ask you, you know, how did you come to write this book? But I think you've already been in some ways describing that. Maybe it would be better to sort of ask that, but tag onto it this question of why did you feel this particular historiographical intervention is necessary now, either in your career or in terms of where we are in art history?
Yes, that's exactly a question I'd like to address or try to grapple with. I definitely think that art history is in a predicament. I guess that's the way I'd put it. And I try to strike a note in the book which is somewhere between hope and pessimism. Sometimes I get pessimistic and I wonder, you know, who's our audience? You know, are we providing for the society what we ought to? And I was struck 10 years ago, and this is maybe one of the genesis points of the book, by a comment by a distinguished colleague of mine in English literature, teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, kind of major scholar, somewhat older than I am, maybe 10 years older. But 10 years ago, he asked me, and it was at a conference, you know, in a reception, he said, whatever happened to art history?
Oh, no.
And, you know, this is a you know, deeply discouraging thing to hear because, you know, I'm publishing books and I think I'm doing art history and all my colleagues are and my friends,
yes.
And, right? And, but he meant it in a kind of, you know, kind of semi-friendly way. He wasn't being hostile. He was just saying, and I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, when I was a student, and he's going back to the 60s and 70s, I guess, and he's saying, you know, there were these major figures, Erwin Panofsky, Ernst Gombrich, and then there were these younger figures emerging like Michael Baxendall, whose first book, you know, was published in 1970 or 71. He's talking about a golden age when that older generation was still active, still alive, and the younger generation. And these were scholars, he's implying, that were read all the way across the humanistic disciplines. So every literature professor and every historian, anthropologists, all the disciplines, they were well aware of those major figures, Gombrich and Panofsky, but also even older figures like Heinrich Werfling, you know, from the early part of the 20th century. And in Europe, not so much in America, but in Europe, scholars in a wide range of disciplines would have been familiar with names like Alois Riegel, Abby Warburg, and many, many others. And it suddenly struck me that, you know, we've lost our audience. And then another friend of mine around the same time, who's an artist and a well-informed artist, well-read artist, and he said more or less the same thing to me. He says, whatever happened to art history's ambition to kind of explain things to the society as a whole? And his frame of reference was not just academia. He didn't care so much about academia. He was saying that for all of us, all literate people, art history was a beacon. Art history was a kind of mediating discipline that was more accessible because you don't have the problem with foreign languages. Anyone can go to a museum and connect directly with works of art. You don't have to study for years to master, you know, foreign discipline, foreign languages and specialized terminology. It had this kind of, I guess, a kind of intellectually democratic promise, which he thought, again, it had lost or sacrificed or basically entrusted to the museums. Like the academic scholars have more or less said, oh, you museums deal with that in the and this is condescending on the part of academics, will say, in your naive kind of way, and your, you know, this promotion of a religion of art and so forth, great masterpieces, you go ahead and cater to the public. We're doing much more critical, challenging studies that address only each other, but really only each other, really only within art history, because as the other scholar indicates, we've lost the readership in literature and so forth. So, you know, it's, then I did some research on this, and I think I'm ready to make the claim that Gombrich, and I know you, but many of our listeners are aware of who Ernst Gombrich is. He wrote The Story of Art, and he wrote many other books which have wide readerships. I believe that he's possibly the humanistic scholar, that is to say, the scholar in a humanistic discipline such as history, literary studies, art history, and so forth, in the entire 20th century with the widest readership. I mean, his book sold millions of copies. I don't think there's any comparable figure in another discipline. So, you know, that, you know, makes me, you know, a little sad about where we are. Another thing, another aspect which I'd want to call attention to, which I think of as an aspect of this predicament, is that I can track over the course of my own teaching career the decline in interest on the part of students, undergraduate students, in older art or pre-modern art. So when I started teaching quite some years ago at Yale, every year there would be, anywhere from 5 to 10, sometimes even more, undergraduate art history majors who wanted to write their senior essays with me. You know, this kind of semester-long projects where they kind of, you know, delve into something really seriously. And they very often wrote them on pre-modern art. So medieval art, Renaissance art, Baroque art, you know, but before the 20th century. And over the years, that number just dwindled. Now, you could say, well, maybe my teaching, got worse. But I don't think so. Teaching probably gets better as you get older. Yeah. Or maybe I just got older and started to represent for them, you know, only old people are interested in this older art. But by the end of my time at Yale, I was getting basically zero senior essay people. Mm-hmm. And I said, what's going on in the department? And they said, well, it's not your fault. It's not like they're working on Rembrandt or Michelangelo, but they're working with another professor. No, they're all writing their senior essays on contemporary art, not even 20th century, because Picasso, after a certain point, and you can speak to this better than I, that's your perspective as a modernist, even Picasso has receded such that he's seen as an old master. So what they mean is by old, I'll tell you an anecdote from a colleague of mine at USC, who is a little younger than I am, and he was he was involved in the art of the 90s. So during the 90s, he was engaged in the contemporary art of that moment and writing about it and so forth. And when he was a young man and he was lecturing at USC on modern and contemporary art. And one of the students came up to him, kind of bright student, and impatiently said, well, professor, like, when are we going to get to when are we going to get to the 2010s? Like, when does this course get to, you know, like where we are now? And he said, cause like, you know, this, after this long slog through the 90s. And so that's the phrase that the student used. He basically was saying like this, you know, the 90s are kind of boring. They've just become a little bit irrelevant. It's great that you're enthusiastic about it, but basically saying like what really interests most of us in this classroom is where we are now and where we're going. Mm-hmm. Now, what is my reaction to that? On the one hand, I feel, well, you know, I'm kind of in despair. I think, well, will there be new scholars of older art coming up through the ranks if that's the attitude of this? Where will we recruit young people who are willing to, you know, study history, learn the languages and so forth? But, and I want to kind of cycle back to the point I made earlier about being protective of art and basically in favor of an art history that is not just respectful, but actually, kind of worships art, like takes art really, really seriously and is unwilling to reduce it to its mere circumstances, or unwilling to materialize, make it, you know, something that's merely material or functional, okay? Now, in the contemporary landscape of art history, and I wonder whether this is your perspective too, I find that the more and more of the people who work on the older art, that is to say, like me, maybe I didn't explain that yet, really, that, you know, that the art historical work that I do, the research I do, which is the bulk of my work, I don't just sit around and write about the history of art history year after year. I do research in historical fields. So in late medieval, Renaissance, and to some extent, Baroque art. So we're talking about, you know, from the 1300s. I just finished a book on 14th century Italian art, so the period of Giotto. That was my COVID project. So starting from around 1300 and going up to, let's say, around 1800, and even somewhat into the 19th century, that would be material I work on, okay, not 20th century. So, however, I feel that a lot of the other people, my peers who work in that field, are increasingly diffident and reluctant to speak directly about concept of art. Increasingly reluctant to designate the object of their study as art. They almost always use art with scare quotes around it. And they'll instead prefer to say, well, we work on images or image culture, or we work on material artifacts, or we work on visual culture, but any number of circumlocutions, but God forbid that saying that we work on art. Well, this goes back to these earlier comments I made were reported from these colleagues who said, well, where are the art historians? Well, I would say that the public, I don't just mean undergrads at elite universities, but everyone out there who loves art and is going to museums and buying art or painting, making, drawing, sculpting, all the people in our society who number in the tens of millions who are very invested in art and feel drawn to art and so forth. These people want to hear about art. All of those listeners and readers want to know about art. And I would say that that's a pact that we made once with society, that we'll, you know, you subsidize us in various ways, and we'll go do research and we'll come back and tell you things about art that are going to make you feel closer to that art. That seems to me a basic pact. Well, that pact has been broken by many of my peers who will tell you that, oh, art is a kind of bourgeois fantasy invented in the 19th century. It's a sort of secular religion. It's meant to replace the old religion. And it's a modern Western construction. And you know, we can't apply the term or impose the term on pre-modern cultures. Well, I would push back against that. But what I want to say is that, and this puts me in this kind of paradoxical position vis-a-vis the younger students and scholars who are obsessed with contemporary art. What do I like about their obsession with contemporary art? I like their obsession with contemporary art because art is in the foreground. They at least believe in art. Mm-hmm. That guy who went up to my friend and said, well, when are we going to get done with the 90s so we can get to the present? That's because he's passionate about art. He's passionate about art that we make now and today, and he's very, very concerned about where it's going, right? He wants to know, like, what's next? What's going to be the next big thing in art? Now, that is very precious. That's very precious to me. And it means a lot to me, too. I also want to know where art is going. I don't understand why we can't preserve that passion about where art is and where it's going when we also study the older art. And we ask not where it's going, but where has it been? Where has it been? What are its various peregrinations?
Yeah. Oh, I find all this so fascinating. There's so much that I want to respond to and sort of ask about. I'm tempted to say, in response, at least immediately, that I wonder how much this sense that you have that students are very interested in contemporary, you know, want to talk about what's happening now, want to know what the next great art is going to be in the way that you're describing, is a function of being mostly in places in the Northeast where contemporary art is really happening. You need to come to Louisiana, Chris, because the students down here are so eager to stay entrenched in not only the Renaissance and the Baroque. They're obsessed with the Baroque. When we leave the Baroque, they're all upset and disappointed and want to go back. But they're actually really interested in, like, Paleolithic art. It's like I have to drag them out of those cave paintings because they find the mystery surrounding them so interesting, and the lack of sort of theories that are firm to explain them. And the closer I get to the 20th century, the more the eye rolling, the no, this is garbage, I don't want to look at this, my dog could have painted that. You know, they're in the South very resistant and skeptical about what art has been in, say, the last I don't know, 70 years or so. And the further we get, the more pushback I get and the more desire to go back to this, you know, art history that worships art that they perceive to be fundamental to the Renaissance and the pre-modern era and having been lost, tragically lost by the contemporary practitioners.
That is incredible what you're telling me, Allison, and you're right. I'm a provincial of the Northeast, and but it makes me think, first of all, you are clearly a very gifted teacher, if you can excite them about all that material. But I don't know what to say, because yes, I should know more about all the different mentalities far from Yale and NYU and so forth. You're right, because now I teach in New York City. We have many foreign students, but they're themselves very cosmopolitan. And at Yale, not only is it in the orbit of New York City, but the Yale University Art School, the School of Art at Yale, is one of the top, you know, three art schools in the country, basically. So it's right in tune with the New York art world. And you're right. I'm like a fish in water there. I don't even realize.
I would never have realized it either, having come from the Northeast and taught in New York City like you have and are. You know, I had no idea what to expect in terms of the difference and had to really adjust in terms of how I teach. I appreciate you saying you think I must be a gifted professor. I think you're right. You get better as you go. And you learn how to gauge yourself to your audience, I think, is really key. And, you know, down here, the other thing is it's so much more traditionally religious and Christian than in the North that I don't have to do a lot of explaining of the narratives and altarpieces and things. They're like, yeah, we know who that is. All right, you know, keep going. Keep tell us more. We know who Samson is. We know who David is. You know, they just get that in a way that in New York, I had to really be like, okay, let me tell you who all these people are. You know, it's very different in a way I never anticipated. And I do think, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm listening with great interest. I have mixed feelings, because part of me would like to have students whom I didn't have to kind of, get on my knees and beg them to love this art. They come with a natural respect. But on the other hand, I don't approve of their attitude towards modern and contemporary art. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do not share that at all. I think that the modernism is an irreversible phenomenon. It just engulfs our whole culture. Modernism is not something that's optional in a way. It's that one has to just live in it and accept it. And I think I would tie this into, because I said earlier, and maybe we'd want to return to that in the context of what we're saying, which is very, very interesting, this kind of resistance to modernism on the part of many people, that it is tied in with art history. Because I mentioned briefly earlier that I thought art history was a discipline that was kind of entangled with modernism in many ways. And the reason I say that is because, let me backtrack a little bit to Romanticism, which is obviously the kind of matrix of, or at least the way I see it, I don't know how you see it, but the matrix of modernism. And I'll say what I mean by that. Romanticism is the big turning point in my book, and it happens sort of in the middle. And what happened in a nutshell is that for the first time, and it happened quite quickly within a couple of decades or so, a number of people started looking with generosity and appreciation at medieval art, medieval European art. If you walk into the Metropolitan Museum or go to the cloisters or any major museum, you'll see medieval Christian art displayed, and medieval secular art for that matter, displayed side by side with equal standing to the works of the Renaissance and Baroque and modern. But that standing and status, the high status that medieval art has as art, is something that was basically invented or discovered for the first time in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Up until then, medieval art was seen as an embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And it was a period of decline when the achievements of Greek and Roman painters and sculptors were forgotten, and painters forgot how to paint, sculptors forgot how to sculpt. They continued, persisted in some traditions, basically. But, you know, to the eyes of a Renaissance painter, medieval art was just an embarrassment. And modernity, that is by modernity now, I mean the Renaissance, was all about forgetting that as quickly as possible, destroying most of it or putting it away in cupboards and replacing it with the beautiful, technically proficient paintings and sculptures of the Renaissance. And I'm speaking of the Italian Renaissance, but also Northern European artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo, Titian, Albrecht Dürer, and so forth, all leading on to the great art of the Baroque, Rembrandt, Velázquez, and so forth. From their point of view, medieval art was just a dark cupboard with it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So suddenly in the late 18th, early 19th century, a certain number of tastemakers, let's call them, started looking again at medieval art, and they said, well, you know, actually, these works have a special quality. They may be crudely made often, but they have a soulfulness. They have an authenticity. They have an intensity. They have a gravitas that many of our modern works of art lack. Modern art was, at that, by modern again now, I'm meaning late 18th, early 19th century, was becoming very self-conscious, very mannered, you know, relying on all kinds of tricks, maybe a little bit looking a little bit too rhetorical and so forth. And by contrast, the medieval art, as primitive as it might be, was in fact more authentic and valuable. And this was a complete overturning of taste, basically. And I call this an ironic mode of thinking about art history. And by ironic, I mean basically a kind of redistribution of value and blame, or praise and blame, whereby the mighty are cast down and the lowly are raised up, you know. And so suddenly all the values get reversed. And it became, you know, by 1820, it became respectable and but still kind of exciting to say something like, well, this anonymous wood carving from the 12 or 1300s is to me more precious and valuable than this, painting painted in Rome in 1590 or something, which is, you know, hanging in an aristocrat's home. And so there's a whole political and a class dimension to this. It's a revolution. Now, what were the features? What were some of the features of the medieval art? And by the way, I should add also, this was the beginning of the appreciation of what we sometimes call non-Western art, but let's just call art beyond Europe. Yeah. So suddenly people start looking at the art of South Asia. They start looking at the art. Now, we can hardly call these primitive traditions, but in the eyes of Europeans, they seemed very, they seemed unfamiliar. So they often judged traditions. They knew that Chinese and Japanese art was not primitive. They knew enough to know that these were in fact much older traditions of art than European. But they were baffled by South Asian art, and they were baffled by African art. But they started to look at them. And as you all know, I mean, as you know very well, Alison, in the early 20th century, Picasso principally, but many other modernists were energized by their encounters with African sculpture. And that's just one of many, many episodes of this kind of ironic embrace of what had seemed remote and forbidding, unintelligible, really, now becomes a resource for creativity. So, what are some of the qualities that they were looking for in African masks or in medieval sculpture, medieval painting? They were looking for qualities of authenticity, we mentioned, but often principles of difference and otherness, of course, but a kind of negativity, sometimes a disorder, a dissonance, let's call it a dissonance. And whereas the previous, let's call it idealist or academic theory of art, the one that was cultivated in the Renaissance and in the art academies that sustained and promoted the Renaissance ideals, from that point of view, form was harmony. The artistic form was meant to be consonant, harmonious, well-composed, well-proportioned. So it was stable. So mastery, stability, order, all of these are principles of that are sustained by reason and so forth. Suddenly, the medieval art and the extra-European art introduced the exact opposite, the possibility that actually disorder, dissonance, conflict, even negativity could become an artistic resource. Now, isn't that just modernism in the arts in a nutshell? I mean, that is the big story. The big story that the West tells itself about its art, and which art history tracked. So that is, in a way, the plot line of my book is the move from. I'm oversimplifying here, but I call it the move from good form to bad form, or from harmony to dissonance. And many, many art historians see this because, remember, they're writing the classic art history of the 19th and 20th centuries, are writing in the centuries, in the decades of modernism. That's what they see happening. And they know they're confused by it. They don't know how to react, because often the art historians are professors, you know, and museum curators. They weren't necessarily in tune with Picasso, but they knew that something big was happening. And they intuited that it was irreversible. So what does that mean, though? What does it really mean if the movement is going from good form to bad form? By bad form, I mean ironic, because I'm not like your students in Louisiana who think that, you know, that modernist art is bad form and it's badly drawn and therefore it's ugly. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, yes, it is sometimes badly drawn, but deliberately badly drawn. Mm-hmm. It is sometimes dissonant and negative, sometimes ugly, sometimes hard to look at. It's challenging. It's disturbing, but all of this is again converted into an artistic resource and into aesthetic value by modernism. But where does this story end? Where does this story end? Like, is it just like a kind of death spiral into nihilism? Is it the end just chaos? Is there, you know, many as philosophers of art and art historians as well have kind of concluded that you can't. You know, it's a ratcheting process. You can't go backwards. You can, but then it's just kitsch. Mm-hmm. You can go backwards, but then it's just nostalgia. Mm-hmm. It loses its authenticity. In order to be contemporary, you've got to kind of bravely push forward, even into modes of art making which initially are certainly unfamiliar and possibly even repellent. Mm-hmm. So how is one, you know, I feel my, I don't have an answer to this. In a way, the book kind of ends with this predicament. I try to end on a hopeful note. I didn't want to strike this kind of, you know, this dark tone, like ringing the bells. And kind of, I wanted to be hopeful, because after all, it doesn't belong to me. It belongs to younger people. So, but I ended the book a little early. You'll have noticed that I stopped in the 1960s.
Yes, this is actually exactly what I wanted to ask you about next. And I'm so glad, you know, for listeners, I might just pause and say, it might sound like we're not talking about the book, but Chris is definitely talking about what's contained in the book in terms of modernism is such a huge theme that you kind of pivot around constantly, return to, circle back to, you know, the idea of irony and its meaning in terms of art, the importance of form and harmonious form versus, you know, non-harmonious form. These are all major points in the book that serve kind of as threads in this web of this larger history that Chris is expounding. But it is a little bit unusual, maybe, that the book ends essentially in 1960, though you do push a little bit in terms of mentioning some figures, of course, in the conclusion that come after this. And I will point out that the conclusion has a kind of subtitle. I hope I'm going to say it right. It's a Latin word, novissima, which means both the beginning and the end in a really fascinating way, as only some of these great words from Greek and Latin can. And it struck me both that I wanted to ask you, of course, about why ending in 1960 or thereabouts. You do talk about it in the book, so I'm asking you to kind of reveal something in the book. But I really wanted to talk about this conclusion because it did strike me as the most polemical part of the book. It was a very different read in many ways than everything that came before it. And I wondered if you thought that was an accurate characterization, or you know, you just described the toggling between hope and pessimism that you have as a scholar and maybe as a human being too. And I saw that so strongly in that conclusion, hope, pessimism, sort of the light that is John Berger and his breakthroughs in the 1970s and the darkness of Nietzsche's nihilism in the 1870s. I mean, it just swings back and forth. And I almost think, I'm not sure where it lands. I almost think I need to sleep on it. It's as though it's the kind of thing I either need to reread to decide whether I think it's negative in the end or that you do end on a positive note, or I need to let it settle. It's something to really think about. I feel like I could read that conclusion every day for a year and probably get something different. Oh no, I don't, I wish I had the time for that sort of exercise, but that conclusion, let's talk about it. So both ending the book at 1960 and whether you think it is polemical in the way that I got a vibe.
Yes, it's polemical, but it's ambivalent, and so that in a way blunts the polemic because I qualify things. I mean, I think that the language is sometimes forceful or aphoristic. I the writing style of the whole book is a little bit aphoristic, which is not everybody's taste. Some people are annoyed by that because it sounds, you know, there are a lot of pronouncements and sentences that are kind of can stand on their own, and that's a style of writing that I like, but it's you'll often find that there's a counter aphorism somewhere else, just a mm-hmm. few pages later. So it's not the aphorisms are meant to kind of how should I say? They're kind of framing devices to say, like, pay attention. Like the language, the aphoristic style of the sentence is telling you to pay attention right now and organize your thinking and think about what this all means. And it doesn't mean that that's the resting point of the argument. About the ending in the 60s, well, I had a premonition, and I wasn't wrong about it. I'll tell you why I know that if I were to have taken the book right up to the present, or even quite close to the present, let's say to 2000. I mean, after all, ending in the early, I kind of do talk about the early 60s. It doesn't really end at 1960 because I do in the conclusion talk about Kubler and John Berger, as you mentioned, who really is a figure of around 1970 or so. George Kubler is a very important figure. Some people would say that's a long way, but you know, Eric Auerbach's Mimesis, it's still widely read book of the post-war period. It was published in German in like 1948 and then translated quickly into English. And Mimesis, the representation of reality in Western literature. It's essentially a history, a rewriting of the history of Western literature from the Bible and Homer all the way up to modernism in a series of chapters which involve close readings of major works of Western literature. It's a book that everyone should read. It's just still so exciting and compelling. But you know, this was a book written in the late 40s. Where does it end? It ends with Virginia Woolf. Hmm. You know, he didn't feel compelled to take it up to the 40s.
Yeah.
He just thought, well, Virginia Woolf, who's writing in the teens of the 20th century, that's a significant moment, and I'm going to end right there. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can decide for yourselves, he's basically saying to the reader, where we've come since then. So part of me said, you know, I was also thinking about, Deleuze's book on two volumes on cinema. Gilles Deleuze, the French philosopher, wrote, it's not exactly a history, but it's more like a kind of philosophical meditation on on cinema, right? Well, this is a book written in the 80s, sort of relatively late Deleuze, but it ends before the 60s, really. It's really a book about Eisenstein and Hitchcock and sort of classic mid-20th century cinema, right? Auteur cinema to a certain extent, but it does not deal with the avant-garde cinema or film, let's say, of the 60s. You know, it doesn't deal with Andy Warhol, doesn't deal with it doesn't really deal with anything in the 60s. It just also ends in like 1960. So he didn't mind ending 25 years earlier because he's not writing, he's not, you know, it's not cultural commentary. Deleuze is not writing a commentary on his own time. Now, I'm not Deleuze, but I also felt like I can do that. I could, we're doing it now. I can talk, if you like, about where is art history now? You know, where are we going? But that will date very quickly.
That's
anything
true.
I say, anything you or I say right now in 2021 about the state of art history or where it's been over the last few years will sound obsolete in 10 years, if not sooner. Mm-hmm. Because it's, you know, it's like the difference between journalism and history, right? You write history and you're trying to define a period or to you know, give a shape to a historical period, and you hope that that is, has some authority and it might last for a while. With journalism, that's not what you're trying to do at all. You're just trying to respond to what's happening and shape people's opinions in real time, as it were, on the fly. And I didn't want that. And I knew what would happen if I started writing about the generation of my teachers. And I'm talking now, and I'm just going to invoke a few names, American figures. There are many in Europe who are equivalent, who are also my teachers. But in America, we're thinking of people like Michael Fried, Rosalind Krauss, T.J. Clark, who's British but taught in America, and Svetlana Alpers, many, many others who were our teachers and who are now, you know, getting on in years, but had an immeasurable impact on the discipline. And Michael Baxendall, who in fact is no longer alive, but belongs to that same generation. And yes, and I've actually written on some of these people. And so it's not that I'm afraid to write about them. It's that I knew that if I were to write about them, that 95% of my readers, at least within art history, at least within, would skip right to that last chapter just to see what I said. Because that's, it's like a gossip page. It's like, it would be just like, I know this sounds ridiculous, and some listeners might think, oh, well, no, I couldn't care less about that. I really want to hear about the Renaissance or whatever. But I can assure you that many readers would have just cut to the chase and read the last chapter on art history since the 70s, basically, which is what we're talking about here. The rubrics are things like the social history of art, Marxism, feminism, psychoanalysis, and then succeeded by much more up-to-date methodologies, what's so-called post-colonialism, queer theory, eco-criticism. The list is endless. The things that we do now, basically. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm not saying that I or anyone would be incapable of coordinating what's happening now with what happening earlier, but I'm kind of leaving it to the reader. Like, you figure it out. I've told you a story that I think you don't know, or you probably haven't heard most of this story. Now you connect the dots and see what happens. I also didn't want to write about living art historians. I just kind of made that a rule. You know, I will tell you, I won't name who, but one of those people I just named who's alive. When I said to this person in an email, I mean, you know, I know these people, they're my teacher generation, but I know them, and I said in an email in a casual way, I can't remember how it came up. I'd like to send you my book, or the person, you know, I said, oh, it's finished, or the book is out, or something like that, History of Art History. And the person wrote back, I quake.
Oh, God.
Meaning like, reading, like, I can't wait to see, like, I'm afraid, but I also can't wait to see how I appear in your book. And I had to write back, like, well, sorry, you're alive, so you're not in it. Like, you're going to, you know, it's going to be a big test for your ego, but you actually might have to read the book knowing that you're not mentioned in it.
Yeah.
You know, and then it would be this huge ego thing, because everyone would be like, well, how come so-and-so got mentioned and not so-and-so? But if you stick to dead people, it's fine. But then what I feared would happen actually did happen. A colleague of mine, a younger colleague who is someone, you know, your age, teaching in somewhere in Europe, I forget, Zurich or Basel, a Swiss colleague, basically teaching a kind of intro to art history. And he wrote to me, he says, well, I haven't managed to get a copy of the book yet, but do you think you could just send me a PDF of the last chapter? Because I want to teach it for my course. Now, he hadn't seen it. He hadn't seen the book. He didn't know anything about the last chapter. He didn't mean the conclusion that you're talking about. He just meant, like, I don't really care about your book, and nor will my students, but except for that last chapter, which he knew would cover like the 80s and 90s and whatever. Yeah. So again,
I'm
just
so glad that I asked you about this, because now I'm totally convinced. Like, you've made me a true believer that you're absolutely right, that if you had done that, so many, including myself, I'm ashamed to admit, I did not read the book in order. I don't know. I found it really fun to kind of skip around and go to places I was really interested in and then circle back to others and then read the conclusion. I was like, whoa, I got to go back. And I think you're right that I would have been a little bit chomping at the bit for you know, your take on these most recent figures, and that it would have been super problematic to talk about anyone who's living. I'm almost like ashamed that I ask you this question, but glad that I did, because now I'm totally satisfied with the explanation. It also makes me want to ask, I hope this isn't too much of a curveball, but I wondered as I read this conclusion, and actually some parts of the book, what order you wrote it in. You know, we don't reveal often as authors that, you know, people think we write it from beginning to end. And for chapter one, of course, I wrote first, and then chapter two came next. But that's never how books get written, at least not how I wrote mine. And I wondered in particular whether you wrote the introduction or the conclusion first. Do you mind answering that one?
No, well, that's easy to answer, but I don't think the answer will be that interesting. But let me, you know what I should do is just very, very briefly explain the structure of the book.
Yeah, because please,
please do. You suggested earlier that our conversation might sound as if we weren't even talking about the book, although you were right, we were talking about the book. All those themes of from good form to bad form and so forth, they are the essence of the book. However, the book is structured in a quite schematic way. It's not just a kind of endless flow of ideas that never get anchored. It's strictly chronological. Mm-hmm. And you know, I borrowed that from a 17th century historian of art called Filippo Baldinucci, who was a Florentine, and he assembled notes. He was he went into the archives in Florence we're talking about the 1600s here. So after Vasari, and he, in a way, he wanted to kind of supplement Vasari by going into the archives and learning more. So he wrote also biographical-based account of Florentine art, but he organized it strictly by decades, based on which decade the artist was most active in. So, you know, so-and-so would appear in the 1540s, so-and-so would appear in the 1550s, and so forth. It was just a way of imposing a kind of a rigid chronological grid. So I did the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the book is structured because I didn't want chapters because this has been done before. You mentioned that this is the first time it's been done in English, but there are about three or four books in French and German that have attempted to do, and Italian, French, German, and Italian, that have attempted to do something similar. And a couple of them are quite bad, and a couple of them are quite good. Mm-hmm. And they were, in some ways, both negative and positive models for me. But that's not many when you think of it. And when you think of, you know, all the many, many decades of art history, the fact that this is really only the fifth book, I would say, that attempted to sketch the whole arc, mm-hmm. and the first one in English. But often the chapter headings for those books are, you know, they're organized under isms, the way art history sometimes are. Yeah. So there'll be like the expressionist moment in art history, or, you know, there'll be the romanticism. There'll be these isms which kind of already govern the content. And I kind of wanted the periodization to be more neutral, just chronological. And just say, well, look, in this period, this is what happened. So I divided up, and I found quickly that in order to have chapters of roughly equal length, the earlier chapters would have to cover wider intervals.
Yeah,
so I begin with like the first, after the introduction, which is relatively long and lays down some kind of preliminary principles, I have a section which is, I think, something like 800 to 1400.
Yeah,
which
it's 600 years, that first one.
It's 600 years, because between 800 and 1400, there is almost no art historical thinking.
Right.
There's plenty of art made. We call it medieval art,
mm-hmm.
right? There's plenty of art made, and there's plenty of thinking about art, and there's even some writing about art, but there's no, or virtually no, art historical thinking. So what is art historical thinking? It is the decision to think about art as something that has evolved over time and that is something that might be coordinated with time. I want to say that the very notion of thinking art historically is counterintuitive and may explain the bafflement of some people confronted with this book who think, well, is it a history of art? What is it a history of, really, right? Well, how do most of us and most people in all times and places react to art? What are they looking for in art? Well, they want art that is beautiful. They want to know, is it well made? Mm-hmm. Has it been well crafted? Is it meaningful? Is it powerful? And these criteria are in some sense thought to be transcendent. They transcend time. Like a beautiful thing is a beautiful thing, and a flower is beautiful, and a sunset is beautiful, and ideas about divinity or God. I mean, these are ideas that span cultures and times, and that art is meant to deliver in a way eternity. It's meant to deliver something permanent, something lasting. Why would anyone think about it historically? Right? Another topic which I want to, I'm just going to preempt you, because I bet you're going to ask about it, is the Eurocentrism of the book.
I wasn't actually, though. I did see that reviews, sort of pushed at that, but I didn't find that something that I was troubled by. Honestly, I thought you did a great job of finding ways to draw in. What was it? There's this one moment where you parallel Vasari, who, of course, everybody thinks the book is going to start with, but you do a beautiful job of waiting, I think, till like page 80 or something before Vasari even makes, the appearance that usually is page one of books or thinking like this. But you compare his lives of the artist to the album preface of Dust Muhammad. And that was just one of so many juicy little morsels of connection to, outside of this Eurocentric vision. I understand, I guess, why reviewers would say that, but no, I wasn't troubled by that, Chris.
Well, I'm grateful that you weren't. I mean, I don't know how to put this. I'm extremely aware and cognizant of this issue, but I'll say two things. This book is based on primary sources. You might have noticed that I almost never deal with secondary sources. That
yes,
is to say, I don't spend any sentences or pages debating with other scholars.
Mm-mm.
The idea of the book is that what I did is, after dividing it up into these periods, is that I went and read all the primary sources that I could, and just actually read them. Not every single word, but you can't, Vasari's 8 volumes, I couldn't read every single word, but
impossible.
Just, I would just steep myself in primary sources. And by that I mean, the people living at the time who wrote in the way that I was interested, who wrote art history of some sort. So this person, Baldinucci, that I mentioned, and then moving on to the 18th century, Johann Joachim Winckelmann, the German historian of ancient art, and also Goethe, the great poet and polymath, who wrote quite a few interesting texts on art history. He's one of the heroes of my book, and so on and so forth. I tried to identify primary sources, and I tried to cast a wide net and include primary sources who were not academic art historians, perforce, because in the pre-modern period, there weren't any professors of art history. So poets and painters, in some cases, philosophers, whoever wrote and thought historically about art. So one of my rules is that, as much as possible, I want to read in the original languages. And I don't feel confident as a historian. I would never work on Russian art as you do, because I don't know Russian, and anything I say wouldn't ring true. But I do know a number of languages, so French, German, Italian, and Latin, and I can do all right with Spanish and Dutch as well. And I feel somewhat comfortable with Greek as well. But and now Chinese, I actually can speak some conversational Chinese, because I taught at NYU Shanghai and studied Chinese for a year. So I do know quite a bit about Chinese art. But nevertheless, my rudimentary Chinese does not help me reading primary sources in Chinese. So for the Chinese material, that is the other great, in fact, it's a greater and longer tradition. I was very, very worried and careful. And I did, of course, have to read some texts in translation, limited to which texts are translated. There really aren't that many. And then I had many conversations with sinologist colleagues, testing my ideas. And basically, my sinologist friends have said, what you wrote is fine. Like, you didn't make any blunders. And that's all I wanted to do. But that would be the true Western arrogance, in fact, is to barge into a field like that and imagine that I could make sense of it. So I was very tentative. Now, apart from the Chinese and also Japanese later on, what are the traditions of writing and thinking art historically? Well, art making is universal. All peoples in all kinds of places have made art, and it's all of great, great value. But art history writing. You mentioned Dost Muhammad, so there's a Persian tradition, you know, Persian and Ottoman tradition of writing. And that has been some important texts like these album prefaces from which I drew that comparison have been translated and well commented upon by excellent scholars. So I felt comfortable making that comparison between these two contemporaries, Dost Muhammad and Vasari. And I made some comparisons with the Chinese, but there isn't much else really. There are limits. If I want to say, well, if you're a sinologist and you feel that there's more that should be told from the reverse perspective, I wish someone who is knowledgeable would write the book in reverse perspective, like write a history of art history that's told from the Chinese point of view, where by the European phenomenon is seen as kind of marginal and on the edges. Why not? I'd like to hear that perspective. I tried to do that. I tried to do that with Dost Muhammad because I said, well, we're all very pleased with Vasari. And in fact, he's one of the protagonists of my book. I'm also very impressed by Vasari. It's a colossal achievement. But on the other hand, compared to Dost Muhammad, his comments on art are rather, they're kind of dry and thin. He just doesn't have Vasari's a wonderful scholar. He was very scrupulous about trying to get the dates right and so forth. But his comments on paintings are not that interesting, really. He often just says, you've read Vasari, he often just says, this painting by Raphael is very, very beautiful. You know, it's just graceful and divine and just so beautiful. And it couldn't be more beautiful. You know, this is not great art criticism. I mean, whereas in the other traditions, including the Chinese, the art criticism or description of works of art is often very, very poetical and very profound. So it took my reading. I had to read in these other traditions in order to put Vasari in a kind of reverse perspective and see his limitations. So I tried my best. So, thank you for not judging me on that. Now, just to go on about the chronology, so 800 to 1400, then 1400 to 1500 I needed only one chapter to cover that whole century. Then I started dividing them up into half centuries. So it goes 1500 to 1550, 1550 to 1600. Then at some point in the 18th century, 19th century, it becomes every 20 years. So 1810 to 1830, 1830. And then in the 20th century, it's every 10 years. So then it's 19-teens, 1920s, 1930s. Each decade gets its own chapter. That's really interesting because it means that the quantity, just the sheer quantity of material, is so great. In fact, at this point, you'd have to divide it up almost into half decades. It would be 2010 to 2015, and that's getting a little crazy. So all that to say, that's the overall structure of the book. Yes, there's a long introduction with some basic principles. Then there are these chronological chapters, which involve me commenting on primary sources with quite a lot of quotes. I like quotes from primary sources, all translated by me. The translations are all my own from the original languages. No, it's not really. It's just that you find when you go back to the originals that the translations often make mistakes. So you got to read the originals if you can. And then it ends, as we said, in the 60s. I forget where that question began.
It's okay. No, I'm so glad. I feel like you're doing something that I'm usually much better about in these interviews, which is at some point sort of pausing and saying, here's the overall structure of the book. There's 21 chapters. They're broken down by this chronology. And I'm so glad that you interjected and sort of returned that sense of the way the book is framed overall, because I think you're right that it's not necessarily a typical way to do it. The isms way would have been the way that when I first cracked the table of contents, I'm not sure what I was quite expecting, because I know your work well enough to know that you go against the grain. You know, you don't necessarily do art history the way that everybody else does. So I tried to open it with just, totally sort of blank slate and absorb what was there. I am so upset that our time is winding down. And I, as always, we get to an hour and I still have tons of questions that I would love to ask. And I'm sure listeners are I'm hoping that they're intrigued and are going to pick up the book and dive in and explore and won't hold me to task too much for all the things that I didn't get a chance to ask. You already hinted a little bit, and I've been sort of waiting to ask this, to return to it. The traditional last question here on New Books Network is just to ask you what you're working on now. And you mentioned something, a book that you finished during COVID. But so tell us about that. And if there's even more on the horizon, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, that is a book that I literally pushed send on just a week ago.
Congratulations. That's huge.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it was a project that it has to do with portraiture and the intervention or introduction of portraits of lay devout people into religious painting. So a kind of encroachment or a penetration of the sacred image by portraits of real people. You know, we call them donor portraits or portraits of the patrons and so forth. This is a big phenomenon, and I'm focusing just on 14th century Florence and Siena. So classic ground of Giotto and his followers, ending around 1400 or early 15th century with Fra Angelico. It kind of tells a story from Giotto to Fra Angelico. It's something I'd been working on for a while, but when COVID came, and in March 2020, and things kind of shut down, and I had done a lot of the research, and I had tons of notes on my hands, but was looking for a space of time to just write it up. So I did. I just sat down and wrote this book, and just finished it. So that it's about the sacred and the profane, basically. It's about the tensions between the sacred and the profane, and how this gets worked out in the medium of painting.
Oh man, I will be so looking forward to this. Speaking of my students in Louisiana, they always ask about these people that you're describing, these donors, you know, kneeling. Or I think their favorite moment is, of course, Enrico Scrovegni in Giotto's Arena Chapel, who so famously has himself included. And that has long needed, I think, a full-length discussion by someone of your knowledge and expertise. And, well, I'll have to have you back on the show to talk about that when it comes out. That's really exciting. I really enjoyed talking to you about your book today. Like I said before, I could keep talking about it with you endlessly. Thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this and answer my questions.
Thank you, Allison. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm very grateful to have had all this time to talk with you.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name, as always, is Allison Lee, and I have been talking to the wonderful Christopher Wood about his book that I hope everybody goes and gets a copy of. It's called A History of Art History. Thank you so much for listening.